We can interact with the arguments that atheists put forward, and they're real arguments. But ultimately, the idolatry Paul talks about here and the atheism aren't the result of ignorance, but of willfully doctoring the evidence.
Yeah, the language here is the attempted suppression of the truth. The idea is trying to drown somebody in, you know, 6 inches of water. You're forcing them down, yet they keep fighting to get back up. That's how the knowledge of God works in a non-Christian. They attempt to suppress what they know to be true, and they can't.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn as we're continuing our Romans Revolution. Does God believe in atheists? Sounds like an odd question, but it's actually more important than whether atheists believe in God. And the answer is, well, first let's back up a little bit. In Romans 1, 9 through 32, which is our focus in this program, Paul has explained that God's wrath is being revealed from heaven against the wicked, and that this is entirely justified. Created in God's image, upright and just in all their ways, Adam and Eve knew God's law. In fact, they had no need of the gospel, since the gospel's the good news of what God has done to save us. Adam didn't need to be saved. He needed to obey God's commands so that he could lead creation in his train into the Sabbath rest and eat of the tree of life. Humanity was originally hardwired, you might say, for law. God created us for obedience and gave us all the requisite abilities for fulfilling the commission he'd given to us to extend his kingdom throughout the world. Reformed theology at least calls this the covenant of works or the covenant of creation. After the fall, of course, not only was any hope of winning the right to eat of the tree of life foreclosed, we couldn't even get back to Eden. The unexpected happened, though. God announced the gospel to Adam and Eve, and thus began the covenant of grace. But what about those who are outside this covenant of grace, who don't embrace its promises? It's just not true that unbelievers don't have a personal relationship with God. Paul, here in Romans 1, says they do. He writes, "For what can be known about God is already plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things he has made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. And they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling a mortal human being, or birds, or four-footed animals, or reptiles." See, it's precisely because unbelievers, even professing atheists, do have a personal relationship with God that they are under his wrath. So even though there are people who claim to be atheists, the fact is that everyone believes in God, but suppresses the truth that they really know to be true, and do so in order to evade the reality of the wrath of God on account of their sin. Not only does God not believe in atheists, atheists aren't really atheists, Paul is saying here. That's his point in these passages of the Romans Revolution. As we continue this series with our usual cast of characters, Dr. Kim Riddlebarger is pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California. Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, Lutheran minister, professor at Concordia University, Irvine. The Reverend Ken Jones, pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California. And I'm Mike Horton. I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. First of all, we've touched on this before a long time ago, but Reformed theology speaks in terms of law and gospel that gets cashed out also in terms of the covenant of works and the covenant of grace. How important are those categories and distinctions to this chapter of Paul's epistle?
Well, the whole backdrop of human sin has to be in mind when Paul begins to discuss suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. It seems to me that if God makes a creature Adam, who is an image bearer and who has all of the communicable attributes of God, he must create Adam in covenant relationship because Adam's a creature and Adam's bound to obey his creator. And so as soon as sin enters the picture, the creature's in violation of that covenant by definition.
So in the first chapter, when he says the gospel is revealed, here he's not talking about the same revelation. He's talking about a revelation from God, to be sure.
The gospel is revealed to sinners.
But this is the revelation that is revealed to all human beings, yep, called general revelation.
Yep.
Well, when he says the gospel, or in the gospel, God is revealed, he makes it very clear that God's saving power is revealed in the gospel.
Not just his creating power.
Exactly. And which that theme is what he takes up later.
Right.
Once he's, you know, now he starts talking about the attributes of God that are visible in creation.
Yeah, in these verses, you do not get a complete exposition of every attribute that God has. What is it that the non-theist is to know from what God has created?
Right.
The Greek is his eternal godness.
Theotes.
Yeah, his godness and his righteousness. Now, that's not a complete theology proper, but it's enough to condemn.
Absolutely.
So we're going to say, when people say, all people of all different faith traditions experience God, we're not going to say, no, they don't. We're going to say,
they do.
They do, but do they experience God as creator and lawgiver and judge? Because that is original to creation.
Right.
All image bearers have that kind of relationship to God. But do they have, after the fall, a relationship to God as redeemer, savior, friend? Here's a clip that sort of illustrates that and sets it in context.
I think religion is an experience. You don't believe because, you know, you've convinced me in an intellectual argument that God is real. I think the biggest thing that religion has going for us is that experience, that feeling you get when you come into a community, and that's what religion is all about.
Oh,
first of all,
it takes my breath away.
I have absolutely no idea what the actual content of that claim is. But,
and how do we know we're talking about the same experience?
Yeah.
There's one thing that the people of this culture that we live in, there's one thing that they have gotten, and that is whatever is religiously true, it has nothing to do with the intellect.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That's a given.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that's important here, we're going to talk about arguments and evidences later, but one of the points that seems really clear from Paul here early in the argument is, look, stop saying that your Gentile friends and relatives don't have any basis for God to judge them because they never knew.
Let's extend that to something that we often hear. What about the person who lives in, you know, some remote part of the world who has never been exposed to the gospel?
How about the person who lives in
how could God judge them? And the question and the issue, according to Paul, is not whether or not they have access to the gospel. The judgment that they are under is because that which has been revealed about God, they have rejected it. They have suppressed that. They have the sun, don't they?
Right.
They have the stars. That's right. Enough for them to recognize the reality of God, the power. And
right. Let me ask you a question. I agree, and mm-hmm. I think that's exactly what this is saying. Are we then saying that we know that all those people will be condemned forever?
You know, the classic statement throughout church history since Cyprian, the church father, was outside the church there is no salvation. I love the way the Westminster Confession qualifies that. Outside of the church, there is ordinarily no possibility of salvation.
Good
because
on.
We really don't know what God has. It's as much speculation on our part to say that every pagan will go to hell.
Right on.
Right.
Because we even have examples in the Old Testament itself.
But that's
Melchizedek
right.
being the
yeah,
primary one.
That's right.
But if any pagan goes to heaven, it's because of the blood and righteousness.
Exactly.
Right. It's not because they're innocent.
I think many times that the fuel for the liberal was a childhood answer to that question that was a bad answer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, and I think the distinction that Kim makes, that somehow the person and work of Christ is applied to whatever individual
and revealed
right.
to them in
yes,
some
and
some
revealed
way.
To them
right.
that they
mm-hmm.
that there is that it is still through Christ, that if anyone is saved, they will still be saved through the same way, and
yes,
that's through
absolutely.
The person and work of Christ.
Absolutely.
Two things seem to be clear from this passage One, everybody knows God, at least as lawgiver, righteous, holy, judge, majestic, infinite, good, creator of all things. So we have to affirm general revelation.
Sure.
And so you have all the religions of the world, at least, that affirm some kind of a great spirit, some kind of principle, will say that this principle or person, he, she, whatever, is in principle good, in principle infinite, in principle just. They have all kinds of theories, for instance, of what happens when you do something bad in relation to this God, because they assume a certain justice there. I think Paul also says here, everybody by nature, apart from God's grace, suppresses that truth in unrighteousness. Doesn't that seem to suggest that ultimately we can say other things about atheism? We can interact with the arguments that atheists put forward, and they're real arguments. But that ultimately, the idolatry Paul talks about here and the atheism aren't the result of ignorance, but of willfully doctoring the evidence.
Yeah, the language here is the attempted suppression of the truth. The idea is trying to drown somebody in, you know, 6 inches of water. You're forcing them down, yet they keep fighting to get back up. That's how the knowledge of God works in a non-Christian. They attempt to continually attempt to suppress what they know to be true, and they can't.
The ball keeps popping up.
Up, and that manifests itself in all kinds of forms of false religion. That's why Calvin said the mind of fallen man's an idol factory. Because we're image bearers, we know there's a God, yet we're sinners, so we try and suppress that. That's what manifests itself in the form of false religion. I put atheism as a false religion. It's the worship of self, and therefore still false.
In Romans 1 through chapter 2, Paul, as he talks about natural revelation, he points it in two directions. One, in the created order, the cosmos. And so we all have access to the cosmos.
That which has been made.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But also natural revelation includes the human being, which he takes up in chapter 2. The conscience, that the law of God, the idea, basic idea of basic right and wrong, is written on every heart. So on both sides, whether it's through the cosmos or whether it's through the conscience, the knowledge of God is revealed, and sinful men seek to hold down that which is revealed for their own purposes.
Now, you ask a lot of people today, even a lot of professing Christians, do you think that Christ is the only way? And a lot of people will say, well, you know, here's how I think it'll all pan out. I think God will hold people responsible for what they know. That is intended to be good news.
Yeah.
What Paul is saying here is you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
God would be unjust to hold people responsible for what they didn't know. But that's not good news. Because the problem is not that we are basically ill-informed. The person in the remote part of the world who's never heard the gospel is just ill-informed. The real problem is whenever you get revelation, whether it's the law or the gospel, whenever you get revelation, here's what you do with it. Here's what you would do with the gospel, too.
And you do get revelation, by the way.
Yeah.
That's Paul's answer.
Yeah, this is what you always do. You suppress the truth in unrighteousness. You twist it. You distort it. The evidence is obvious, it's clear.
And you exchange it for a lie.
You turn it in, you exchange it. That's
knowledge,
a great term.
Knowledge means accountability.
Yes, absolutely.
And people don't want to be accountable. I'm reminded of a story of two guys getting on a bus after work, and the bus begins to fill up. So as they're sitting there, one guy starts to go to sleep. His buddy elbows him and says, "Wake up, are you going to miss your stop?" He says, he keeps his eyes closed and he says, "I'm not asleep, but if I open my eyes, I have to give up my seat."
That's great. Well, having said all that, you know, we're not born into the world neutral. We're not born into the world without a bound will. We're born into the world hating God and receiving his revelation, but twisting and distorting it. Given that argument here that Paul makes, is there any value then in presenting arguments and evidence to someone who professes to be an atheist or agnostic?
Absolutely. There's great value in it. As Calvin himself said, and trying to convince a non-Christian that this is all true in some sense is like beating the air, because it takes the Holy Spirit to bring people to a saving relationship with God. But he says, on the other hand, it shuts the mouth of the obnoxious unbeliever. So in the one sense, it has the purpose of slapping down those who raise up ridiculous, futile arguments against Christianity and who kind of horn in and prevent the gospel from getting hearing. Uh-huh. I like to think of this as Francis Schaeffer said, that apologetic arguments are like the law. you can leave a non-Christian under condemnation.
Absolutely.
And give
taking
him
the roof off.
Taking the roof off and allow the weight of his non-Christian presupposition to come crashing down. And Christian evidences are great for doing that.
A number of years ago, I was on a panel with a scientist who is famous for trying to debunk religious claims. And we went around the table, and there were, you know, various people of different religious faith traditions, faith communities.
I hate that phrase.
Faith tradition.
But I like the way you say that.
Thank you. And they were all talking about, you know, what religion does for you and so forth. Nothing objective, nothing historical. And he was very good at debunking all of those claims. And then it came time for me, and I said, first of all, thank you so much for, I think, delivering a good response to all of those claims. I would agree with you on all of those points.
Yes.
Now, if I could talk about Christianity.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Good.
And good for you.
So I started talking good. About yeah. evidences for the resurrection.
Good.
And it was really remarkable. We got to a certain point, and he kept responding back with this answer and that answer. And he said, well, here's what I think. I think that Jesus didn't really die. I think that he really was carried off by the disciples and revived and so forth. I said, yeah, that's actually been pretty
swoon theory.
Soundly refuted. Not exactly by fundamentalists, by right. a lot of people. That's been around for a long time. Went through each of his objections.
Uh-huh.
And I said, there's this great article in the Journal of the American
Medical Association.
Yeah. On you know, a panel that uh-huh. Concluded, based on the medical evidence that we have reported there and that we know now and they couldn't have known then, we conclude that we don't know what happened after his death, but he died on the cross.
Yep.
And his response was, what a bunch of malarkey. I said, yeah, you never can trust the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Mm. Yes. Mm.
And there, something cracked, and we talked a little while afterwards.
Good.
I still haven't had responses to my last email, at least there was some. I've had the same conversation with Richard Rorty, a postmodern skeptic,
yep.
where he said, in fact, if I had ever heard something like that, I've never heard this kind of an argument for Christianity. Yes, it would be a different kind of claim than the one that I'm including yeah. as religious malarkey.
Well, Anthony Flew said that too after years ago after a debate or a presentation he gave up in Canada. It was Q&A and nothing official going on. And one InterVarsity guy said to Anthony Flew, what if the tomb was empty the third day? Flew turned to him as if he'd never really thought about it. And he said, well, of course, that would change everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
in both of these, just to finish that, in both of these instances, and this was sort of my point, in both of these instances, however, they both threw up a wall and
said,
I'm not going to believe this. Now, we can either say,
I'm glad you did what you did.
Yeah, we can either say, see there, it just doesn't do anything to present arguments and evidences. Mm-hmm. The Holy Spirit has to do it. Or we can say, now, wait a second, apply that to preaching.
Sure.
Yeah.
God uses means, and even if they never come to faith, that's
yep.
God's business, not
yeah,
mine.
Absolutely. That's right.
Even if they never come to faith, they are more accountable for what they've heard,
yeah.
and B, God might use it to bring them to the faith by showing them, and here's the law work you were talking about, by showing them that it's not a lack of evidence.
Yeah.
It's not a lack of arguments.
Sure,
it's that they are actively, ethically suppressing the truth in unrighteousness.
Yeah, your responsibility is to answer the questions.
Sure.
But that's the thing. Just to say that our arguments and evidences don't lead people to salvation
yeah. uh-uh.
doesn't mean that they don't lead them to something.
Or
that we
ought not do it.
Right.
Well, and this takes us back to the previous program when we talked about, when we listened to all those interviews and everyone was defining Christianity by experience. It is mm-hmm. not by our experience. Christianity, as you go back to Romans 1, he makes it very clear. According to the scriptures.
Yes.
Same thing in his
yes.
apology on the resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15.
Yes.
According to the scriptures.
Yeah.
And this is where we begin. We try to explain the scriptures.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think Francis Schaeffer, again, nailed it when Schaeffer, his little short chapter in God Who Is There, pre-evangelism is no soft option.
Uh-huh.
A lot right. of times, giving evidences is in effect pre-evangelism because you're giving people the categories. You're able to refute the kind of nutty ideas that these people were throwing up in the interviews. You're able mm-hmm. to give mm-hmm. them reasons as to why what they just said so authoritatively is a bunch of hooey.
Yes.
Yeah. So that at least the spotlight now is on, okay, what do I do with this?
Yeah,
sure.
Whereas before, I don't need to do anything with this because it's a bunch of hooey.
Yeah.
There are the so-called nature psalms like Psalm 19, Psalm 104, the heavens are telling the glory of God. Mm-hmm. All of God's creatures reflect his goodness, wisdom, and majesty. Continuing in this vein, Paul says that the natural world displays clear evidence of God's existence and invisible attributes.
Mm-hmm. Anthony Flew,
recently, tell that story.
He's, he was the key atheist, the clearest thinking in the English-speaking world. He was my foil in my dissertation because he was the best, and in his 70s or 80s has come to reject his atheism. Why? It was the arguments of the guys from Intelligent Design.
Yeah. Yeah.
The ID fellows, and it cracked his atheism. Now, that probably caused a lot of bother in the atheist community because he was respected as the best of the best. Mm. But that's what did it.
Not just particular arguments, because you could have weaker Intelligent Design arguments,
yes,
and stronger ones.
Yes.
But doesn't the, what's called the teleological argument,
yes,
the argument from design,
yes,
doesn't that argument display in stark terms how unbelievers suppress the truth in unrighteousness when you go to the doctor? You know, how could you be a medical doctor and not see design? How could you be an astrophysicist and not see design?
Any form of mathematics, music, or engineering.
Right. It seems to me that if you were in any of these fields, you look at the mathematics of chance and contingency,
sure,
and
sure,
so forth, you just have to twist and distort and come up with outlandish hypotheses in order to not accept
and we have.
The design.
And that's exactly what's happened. But again, to use a term from the therapeutic culture, we live in denial.
Yeah. And of course, Mike, you didn't mention the most powerful teleological argument, and that's baseball.
You and George will?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I would join that group.
I think baseball is a great argument.
Except when they go on strike and then everybody becomes atheist.
Logan, that's the testimony to the fall.
Holy smokes.
Arguments against God use logic, but where does logic come from?
The whole transcendental argument is just very effective in that regard.
Yeah. Does this mean that people then can discover the gospel? I mean,
No. That's such an important point. That's why I think Christian evidences are so important. Because tactically speaking, the evidences for the authority of Scripture and for the resurrection of Christ get you to the gospel.
Yeah.
You can believe in Aristotle's prime mover and perish eternally. You can be a deist and perish eternally.
Or a theist.
A theist.
Yeah.
The arguments that tend to support special revelation, that is, that the Bible is the Word of God and that Jesus rose again from dead, those arguments get you right to the critical issues quickly. And tactically, you go right there.
We really do have to make a distinction between apologetics and evangelism. Apologetics is simply answering the questions that are put to us, the challenges, the objective challenges.
And to argue that the gospel's true.
Sure. To argue the truthfulness of the gospel, the authority of Scripture, to argue all of those things, to give answers. But it's not the same thing as preaching or sharing the gospel.
Right. And it seems like later, Paul makes this explicit when, after going through all of this, he says, but now the righteousness of God is revealed from heaven. In other words, here I'm going to talk about natural revelation and how it condemns you. So the natural revelation, general revelation because of the fall, leads us to culpability.
Right, right.
But now a righteousness apart from the law, whether in nature or in the Ten Commandments, has been revealed from heaven. So here, clearly, Paul is saying what you have in general revelation is not the gospel, but the law. Every human being is a covenant of works person unless placed in the covenant of grace.
I think it's important when you talk about the relationship between evangelism and apologetics to look at Paul in practice. Look at the sermons that Paul gives in the book of Acts. He basically ties Christ to fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. He shows how Jesus is God's son based on the resurrection. So he proclaims the gospel to these people, and it's a factually based gospel. And then he answers objections.
Yeah.
In the case of pagans, they're more teleologically and cosmologically based. In the case of Jews, it's fulfilled prophecy that Jesus is the one you run scriptures for. So I think Paul gives us a great pattern as to how to do this.
Well,
you
preach
the gospel and then respond to objections.
And it's stated throughout Acts as Paul goes through preaching and teaching in different places that he both preached and reasoned with the people.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And the reasoning certainly lends to the idea of debating and answering arguments and objections to the message.
And Paul says we know from nature God's invisible attributes, his power. He mentions his eternal
godness
power
and power.
Godness mm-hmm. and power. He does not mention that we learn from the Alps and a beautiful sunset
that he's triune,
or that he's gracious.
Yep.
Or merciful.
Or that he is the Redeemer.
Yep.
Yeah.
All that is missing from natural revelation.
Yeah. So, nor does he say that we worship God through going skiing.
Right. Yeah. Pastor has to say that.
That's pretty close.
Pastor has to say that.
Here we can affirm, yes, people do experience God
sure.
outside of the gospel, outside of the church, outside of preaching and sacrament. Yes, people do. But that doesn't mean that everything in the world is a sacrament.
Right.
It means that everything in the world witnesses to God, testifies to God, but it's a means of law,
yeah,
not a means of grace.
It's only to his power and to his godness.
And its purpose, the reason why this revelation is given, is to leave men and women, as Paul says,
without excuse.
Yeah. And it's condemnatory.
Without seeing God in all that he has created, you end up with Ecclesiastes.
Yeah.
You end up with life under the sun.
Yep.
With no meaning and purpose. Yep.
Warfield's point, when he discusses this at great length in his book, The Inspiration Authority of the Bible, makes the case that this provides the entire set of categories necessary to understand special revelation.
Yeah.
This is the framework for which God to enter history mm-hmm. now and speak.
And isn't it important for us to realize that it's not that this revelation is inherently condemning? This revelation would have been fine. It would have been wonderful. We don't need a revelation of the good news of the gospel.
Right.
That we can be saved from our sins until we're sinners.
Yeah, it served Adam pretty well in Eden.
But this revelation of God in nature, his eternal power and Godhead, only become damning for us because of who we are.
Sin. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Estranged
from God. That's
a great
point.
Natural revelation should lead us to immediately fall on our knees and worship the Creator for all that is revealed and what he's created. But because of sin, first off, we attempt to suppress what is revealed, and then we take that impulse of worship and praise and we misdirect it. We either worship what he has created rather than the Creator, mm-hmm. or we elevate ourselves to that place of exaltation.
How does Paul say this suppression of the truth and unrighteousness reveals itself?
He goes on to talk about the false religion that arises from the human heart. Where does the religious impulse come from in every tribe and every culture and every tongue under heaven? It comes because people are truth suppressors. And the suppressed truth bubbles up in the form of false religion. And false religion most frequently takes the form of idolatry. So this explains why you can find very good and useful and true things in all forms of pagan religion, because they steal it from natural revelation,
uh-huh.
and then somewhere they take the credit for having stolen it.
So can we say there are two extremes here? One extreme is to say that there is no truth, there is no revelation of God outside of the Bible. Non-Christian religions can't know anything that's true. And then on the other extreme, to say that they can understand the gospel through nature.
Right. Right.
What we're saying here is, look, there's this whole vast territory called things below, things earthly.
Creation.
This whole territory that is not atheistic, but is the creation of God that reflects his glory, that preaches God, but it doesn't preach his gospel. It preaches his righteousness, holiness, and justice. And that's why all the religions of the world throw their kids into volcanoes,
mm-hmm. yep.
have karma, and coming back in the next life promising to do better, and here follow these steps, because law is in us
part
by nature.
Creation. Yes.
Yeah. So in other words, there is a validity to the religious impulse in whatever religion, But that's not the same thing as the pluralism or the pluralistic, relativistic understanding of religions that's so dominant today that all religions mm-hmm. are essentially saying the same thing. The impulse is there by virtue of the creator.
I think all
but
religions,
the expressions are different.
I think all religions but Christianity are saying the same
yes.
thing.
Yes. That's some form of law
yeah.
that
right.
works
yeah.
righteousness.
And they can get some of that right. You know,
even the response to it.
Sure.
Right. Karl Rahner, one of the main architects of the Second Vatican Council, Roman Catholic theologian, is known as the main architect of what's been called the anonymous Christian idea. And it's this idea that basically all good people, even atheists who by their good actions show that the grace of God is at work in their life, will be saved through Christ, but without any knowledge of the gospel. But he would say that's because everybody born into the world is open to transcendence. Now, of course, we would say, yes, open to transcendence. Everyone born into the world knows mm-hmm. there's a God and is in a certain sense searching for that God, but not the one who really reveals himself as the God of wrath, the God of justice, the God of holiness. So we would go that far with Rahner, right, and say, yes, open to transcendence, but he calls that transcendent grace.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we would say
open
to transcendence because we're created in the image of God, exactly. but after the fall,
if we are
Isaiah 6 is the picture.
Yeah.
You know, I'm undone. Woe is me, for I am undone. The transcendent knowledge did that to Isaiah.
If we are image bearers, then we're going to be able to pick up and understand the revelation that God gives through nature. So it isn't as though the revelation doesn't get through. So we have to agree with Rahner that the revelation gets in there. Mm-hmm. But where Rahner goes awry is by not acknowledging Paul's point here, that when that revelation gets through, because of sin, that revelation is inevitably distorted, and it's suppressed, and it's exchanged, as Paul says, for a lie, so that men worship and serve created things rather than the Creator who is to be forever praised. So there's a culpability to this suppression that non-Christians don't want to acknowledge, that the very fact that you come up with a wonderful non-Christian religion renders you guilty before God.
Mm-hmm.
You suppress the truth in unrighteousness.
Well, then Paul gives other examples. He says, let me give you an example of how far people will go to deny general revelation in order to deny God, which means to run away from his wrath like Adam and Eve in the garden. People will exchange natural affections, even knowing the biology that says you don't do that, men don't do that with men, women don't do that with women. We will even twist and distort science, biology, the most obvious evidence of design, because back of that, we run into God.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how far we'll go. This isn't intelligence.
Yeah.
This isn't wisdom. Paul is saying, look how foolish will be in our suppression of truth.
And look at how rebellious we are, the great extents that we will go to suppress what is evident.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Paul said, because of this, God gave them over. He in his wrath, withholds his grace that keeps us from sinning more, and he allows us what we call the downward spiral in Romans chapter 1, where sin now snowballs and it picks up speed and it gets bigger and more difficult to stop. It becomes an avalanche by the time you get to the end of that.
You bring up an important point, Kim. A lot of the preaching you hear from, I think, conservatives on this point is, in fact, I remember a friend we know, he struggled with homosexuality, and his pastor told him, God has given you over.
Oh. Because of the struggle.
Yeah, because of the struggle. And
which was the sign, really, that God hadn't given
that's
him over.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Paul isn't to the gospel yet.
That's
it's
right.
important for
right.
us
right.
to realize that, what right. Paul is saying is exactly what you said, Kim. He's not saying that he's given them over in his redemptive purposes. He's saying his restraining common grace, wherever you see people exchanging natural affections, what you see is God pulling back his common grace, not his saving grace, his common grace.
And letting sin run its course.
And letting sin happen. Yeah.
Which
and,
is part of him displaying his wrath.
Yeah.
But as Paul himself says in 1 Corinthians, and he reminds the people, this is what you were. This is where the grace of God is seen as against the wrath of God, that God takes those who are under his condemnation and brings them into relationship with him. That is his grace, and he's the people that he saves were those who are described in
this. That's right.
I think it's vital when we talk about Romans when we read the sin list that Paul gives.
Yeah, the whole list.
The whole list, because we tend to think, well, there's obviously homosexuality in this passage, and that's the big sin. But the way Paul reads this, he says, furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. And so we think because he's mentioned homosexuality, that's what he's talking about. He goes on to say, they become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, of course. Mm-hmm. Slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and
now
boastful.
He's describing a lot of people who today
disobedient
go after
homosexuals.
They invent ways of doing evil. And the end of the list here, they disobey their parents.
Yeah.
That condemns the entire human. Yeah. Paul has just leveled the whole human race.
But Kim, one more. At the very end of it, he says, and not only those that do these things, but those who approve it.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
So those who don't even engage in the conduct but who approve of others who do are at the bottom rung of the downward spiral.
Yeah.
So Paul is saying here is the umbrella. Under the wrath of God is everybody. Whereas the way we often preach these texts is here we are over here not justly under the wrath of God.
You are.
You are because
Yeah.
You're described here in these verses, but if we read on, read the whole list, we all step under the umbrella. And now instead of preaching the wrath of God as something that Democrats deserve, we're preaching the law.
Regardless of how true that might be. I just had to say that.
We're preaching the law now as something that all of us deserve.
Right. Well,
and that's a different kind of preaching of the law.
And that's his point in chapter 2. In chapter 2, he goes back to chapter 1 in essence and says, okay, you see, this is what all of you are, whether you are the Jews who had access to special revelation or whether you are Gentiles who only had access to natural revelation and your own conscience. This is what you have all become.
Nobody's left standing when Paul's done.
By the time Romans 3 is finished.
Now, why is all of this important to the rest of Paul's argument?
Because the gospel is about what God has done in Jesus Christ to rescue us from the mess we're in Romans chapter 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, our self-made mess.
Our self-made mess.
Yeah, grace is really not that big a deal if sin is not that big of a deal.
That's right.
When atheists say that something is right or wrong, whether it's an argument, whether it's a practice, whether it's a... Again, I refer to Richard Rorty. Richard Rorty says religion is a conversation stopper. And in one of these meetings that I was a part of, he was laboring the point that basically religion is not about arguments. Religion stops arguments. It stops real thinking, real reflection. And what became obvious to some of us sitting around the table was that he was stopping the conversation by dogmatically asserting something that wasn't an argument. If you say even that religion is a conversation stopper, you're making a judgment about right or wrong. You know, are they judging?
Well, absolutely they are. And that's the thing I think we as Christians have to point out, that the intolerance here isn't on the side of those who are willing to consider yea or nay. And I think we as Christians have to be very clear. It's the Apostle Paul who, you know, gave people like Pascal and others the idea of a wager. Hey, if Christ is not raised, your faith is in vain, and you among all men are to be the most pitied. I mean, it's Paul who bases the whole kit and caboodle on whether or not the tomb was empty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lesbian Tammy Bruce was amazed when she finally met a few Christians. She was told by the radical left that she had been so buddy-buddy with for so long what it would be like if she ever met some. And she met some. And they were pretty tolerant of her lesbianism and her mess. And gave her a copy of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. She says throughout the book, this is her first one, I think, Death of Right and Wrong, and one of the themes in there is, if I were to become a Christian, it would be because of the writings of this man, Lewis. If anything were to draw me to become a Christian, it would be him arguing that it was true.
Yeah, you know, when you mentioned the lesbian thing, and we talked about the list that Paul has there, We have to be so careful of how we handle that list, because what we have a tendency to do is look at the obvious sin in others and beat them over the head.
She was jarred that Christians didn't do that.
And this is what I think an audience that we really need to try to reach in a more gracious way.
Absolutely.
Are the homosexuals.
Absolutely.
Because the reason they are floored that Christians would respond that way is because the homosexual community has become a highly politicized movement,
mm-hmm.
and the Christian right has become a highly politicized movement. So the only way they encounter each other is in protests on different sides of the street carrying different signs. And here you have a great example of what can happen if we actually engage in neighborly
conversation
mm-hmm. and care for each other.
And give reasons as to why we are Christians.
As we do with people like ourselves who struggle with envy.
Sure.
Greed, and gossip.
Disobeying our parents. You go down the list.
Yep. I remember
fornication.
A friend saying, well, you know, this AIDS epidemic is God's judgment on the homosexual community. Well, if you actually go to Africa, you find that it's little children, orphans. It's hard to explain the problem of evil in the light of...
And heart disease is God's judgment on the obese.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I did tell this person, it's a good thing he doesn't pass out diseases for gossip or our churches would be empty.
Yeah, it's exactly right.
Because here Paul is saying we're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
As bad as homosexuality is, and Paul says that. He uses it as an example. It's against nature. As bad as that is, like these other sins, they're all heinous because every sin is done with a high hand. Mm. Every sin is an act of suppressing the truth actively and persistently in unrighteousness.
And it's an offense against the holy God. Therefore, the payment for even gossip and disobeying the parents requires an infinite sacrifice to satisfy God's infinite offense.
David writes, against thee only have I
sinned
and done that which is evil in thy sight.
After
that text,
Bathsheba and Uriah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that text, Leon Morris uses that, and it's a good one to use, that all sin is directed against God.
That's the important thing.
We can't blow one up to such a degree that the person that is guilty of that doesn't feel comfortable coming to the one place that they can receive
redemption.
The same statement that all of us receive, and that is Romans 8:1, there's no condemnation. We need to be able to tell that homosexual, that whatever that the person may be guilty of, that if your faith is in the person and work of Jesus Christ, he says even to you,
to the
there
glutton,
is no condemnation.
And here, connecting the vertical to the horizontal, it really helps, doesn't it? The two tables of the law, love of God, love of neighbor.
Yeah.
To be able to say, yes, on the horizontal scale, some sins are greater than other sins. Some sins damage neighbor more than other sins.
Sure. Murder. Yeah.
But before God, all sins are the same.
Yeah.
Because as you say, Rod, based on Psalm 51, every single sin is flipping God off.
Yes.
Yeah.
Every
yeah.
single sin that we commit, the sin that I commit today, when I'm impatient, when I am greedy, when I'm envious, every sin that I commit, when I gossip, every sin that I commit is exactly the same kind of sin as any other horrible sin on the horizontal level, because
this applies to the condition of sin, which runs deeper than the sin.
Right.
That's exactly right. That's why Jesus could say, he says to women, if you looked at a man with lust in your heart, let's flip that one around.
Yeah.
You are guilty of adultery.
And that's why I've tried to point out what we've lost is a concept of original sin.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it's very easy to do these things on sins comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
But we're functioning Roman Catholics and Wesleyans if we let it stay there.
There's no hierarchy.
The Reformers knew that the deeper problem was the condition of the heart, the doctrine of original sin.
Yes, absolutely.
And that what really condemns is that one. Yeah.
So the real problem
absolutely.
Is not, if we could just get rid of this social evil, that social evil, and that social evil.
Or my personal ones, my list of six.
If I could clean up my dirty thoughts or whatever.
The Christian left and the Christian right are simply applying to the political sphere the Arminian theology they've been implying to the individual for a long time.
And they have
if I can stop this sin or that sin, now it's if I can stop that social sin or this social sin, the left and the right do it together.
And don't go to Arminian churches and don't go to liberal churches. Yeah. Don't go to either one.
Yeah, and the liberal left and the liberal right both hail from Finney. It's a common ancestry.
Yeah, total depravity does not mean every single individual will act out every conceivable sin they're capable of. What it does mean, number one, is that we are corrupt in all of our parts, in all of our faculties, and collectively you will see demonstrated at least a greater portion of the evil that fallen men are capable of. So you may not commit this particular sin, but it's in you. And somewhere in the vastness of humanity, the worst of deeds will be carried out.
Think of the way our country is so revivalistic in its history that even in a nation where abortion on demand is tolerated, we have sin taxes on tobacco and alcohol.
Yes. They're not forbidden by Scripture.
It's just really remarkable. That's how far we come, as Christians too, to suppress the truth and unrighteousness. It's not just the world that does this. We in the church sometimes suppress the truth, not only in the gospel, but even in the law.
Yeah.
And next week, we'll talk about why all of this is important as we begin to make a transition to that righteousness which comes from heaven, revealed from heaven in the gospel. We've had a great discussion here and preparing the backdrop for the good news to come. Thanks for listening to the White Horse Inn as we are in the Romans Revolution.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.